Okay, thank you very much, everybody. We're going to get started. I appreciate everyone who came on time. This is our first 2014 meeting of the House-only Transportation Finance Committee. I'm Representative Frank Hornstein, Chair, and I'd like to welcome everybody. Just a couple of announcements before we start our formal hearing. I wanted to let people know about a couple of staffing changes for our committee. Rachel Nelson, who has been the and will be for the remainder of the week the committee administrator, is now going to be the DFL caucus research staff person. So we welcome you to your new position. Katie Hatt, who was formerly in that position, has moved on to other things. And we're still waiting to see who our new replacement will be for the position, for the legislative assistant position. We also have a new page. Mr. Marco Lenz is here. Marco, welcome. And I don't know if you want to share with the committee just a tiny bit about your background and how you came to us.
I graduated from St. John's in 2005. I've spent the last 5+ years living in China, and I just moved back and want to get involved in Minnesota public policy.
Welcome. Well, thank you very much. So we'd love to hear more about your experiences as we move on. Representative Houseman.
And Mr. Chair, I hope everyone looks at the Star Tribune today, because the pages all got their a colored picture in the,
yes,
in the Star Tribune. Nice size. You can
front
see all
page.
Their faces and recognize, yeah, everybody.
They were getting their instructions on the first day. So, okay, so in terms of our hearing today, we have a couple of items on our agenda. The first is a overview of the Corridors of Commerce program. As many of you know, with bipartisan support, we were able to pass this program into law, the enabling legislation, and we also were able to allocate $300 million in bonding for that program last year. MnDOT has actually started implementation of this. Some initial projects were chosen, among them I-94, and then there were several others. So what we're going to do for the first part of the meeting is get more information about how this program has been implemented, and I would encourage any questions or comments from the committee about this. We've already heard a couple of local officials came at our informational hearings with the Senate and discussed the impact and importance of this program in their communities. But today we're going to get MnDOT's perspective on it, and after that we're going to have another presentation from MnDOT on the state of the MnPass program, and I'll just introduce that part of the agenda by saying this item comes out of a series of meetings that myself, Matt, our committee administrator, had with Representative Holberg and members of MnDOT staff to discuss some concerns about MnPass and get some questions answered. And so this hearing is kind of a compilation of those conversations, which are ongoing. And I really wanted to thank Representative Holberg for initiating those and participating in those conversations. We had several meetings during the interim. And so this is an update on that. As you may recall, there's been some legislation kicked around in the past to expand the MnPass program, and we have held off on that in an effort to get some of these issues and concerns raised. So thank you, Representative Holberg. And then one final thing, it feels almost like bill deadlines already. I have a bill in another committee, the old bill in another committee, and so at some point I'm going to be needing to leave our hearing, and our very able Vice Chair, Representative Bernardi, will take the gavel at that point. So with that, thank you very much, members. Representative Holberg.
Well, and Mr. Chair, if Blaise Olson is right, I think it's the Vice Chair's birthday today. Is that correct?
I think that would be correct.
How did I miss that? Oh, boy. Yeah, I called you. I called her on her birthday to tell her she was chairing the committee. So, well, let's wish everybody a very happy birthday for Representative Bernardi. So thank you for that, Representative Holberg. So we'll start off with our presentation on Corridors of Commerce. Do we have a forum already? Okay, let's get our minutes out of the way here. So We have several sets of minutes in your packet. The first is April 15th. Wow, we met on tax day last year. February 10th and February 18th and February 10th. Those were our two joint meetings with the Senate, and then we had our last meeting last year was on the 15th. So let's see, Representative Bernardi, do you move the minutes?
Yes, I'd like to move the minutes.
Okay, the minutes are moved. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed, the motion prevails. Great. Okay, we have Mr. Peterson. Welcome to the welcome back to the committee. Happy New Year.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's a pleasure to be here. For the record, my name is Scott Peterson. I'm the Director of Government Affairs at MnDOT, and we appreciate the opportunity to come today and talk about the progress we've made with the Corridors of Commerce program. The chair already mentioned some of the information I intended to provide, but so I'll just skip that and just say the appropriations for the Corridors of Commerce program that were passed last year, the $300 million in bonds, aren't available until July 1st of this year. So we've been busily working, identifying projects that are eligible for the funding, and most of you have some familiarity with some of the projects that were selected, and we're very happy to have the opportunity to get to work on some of these projects that represent improvements that have been kind of awaiting investment for quite some time in many cases, and so we're making good progress. And to give you more of the details on it, we have Mark Giesecke here, who's been a key player in that whole process again at this point, so I'll just turn it over to him.
Okay. Welcome to the committee, and please state your name for the record.
Thank you. My name is Mark Giesecke, and I'm the Director of the Office of Transportation System Management at MnDOT. And I'm happy to be here to give you an update on where we're at with Corridors of Commerce and a little bit on where we're standing for the future of the program. As Scott mentioned, Corridors of Commerce was a new highway program that was passed into law in 2013. Corridors of Commerce is designed to improve the climate for commerce with some targeted system expansions or removal of barriers to commerce by preserving or improving existing highway infrastructure. The Corridors of Commerce is a little bit similar to the Transportation Economic Development Program, or TED, but it does not require that same proven link to job creation that TED does. Corridors of Commerce is meant to improve the transportation system in ways that kind of enhance the general climate for commerce, make it more attractive, rather than targeting to a specific job creation. There are two different classifications of projects in the Corridors of Commerce program, and a project must fit into at least one of those in order to be eligible. The first class is called capacity development. And within that, there are four different subclasses that would define a project that fits in this category. The first one is a roadway that is not a divided highway, and that the highway is an expressway or freeway on either end of the project. So this is the fill-the-gap kind of projects, where you have a two-lane section in the middle of a four-lane section, kind of like Trunk Highway 14, which was one of the projects that was selected. The second category is a project that contains a highway terminus that lacks an intersection or interchange with another trunk highway, so where there's an incomplete connection, such as Trunk Highway 610 would be an example of one of those. Three is that it addresses a bottleneck in an area where there are fewer lanes of travel than there are in the adjacent section, so that might be extending a two-lane or extending a four-lane into a two-lane area of a roadway. And the last one is a project that contains a location that is proposed as a new interchange or to be reconstructed from an intersection to an interchange. Second classification is for freight improvement or asset preservation projects that replace assets that will result in improvements to freight or remove the barriers. So there are also four categories for that one. The first one is a project that removes or reduces barriers to commerce, such as maybe replacing a restricted bridge would be an example of that. The second category would be a project that eases or preserves freight movement, such as perhaps replacing poor pavement or improving intersections for the turning movements of trucks. The third one would be a project that supports an emerging industry with a transportation need. And the fourth one is providing connections between the trunk highway system and other transportation modes for the movement of freight. So if a proposed project fits into one of those classifications, one or both, then the project must also meet certain eligibility criteria, and these criteria come directly from the statute. The first one is that the project may not already be in our State Transportation Improvement Plan, or the STIP, so this is a new project or a project that's being advanced from years beyond the STIP, which is 4 years. it can be in our long-range plan, but it doesn't have to be in any of our plans. The second criterion is the projects outside the metropolitan district must be on what we call the interregional corridor system, or one of the interregional corridor system's supplemental freight routes. Inside the metro district, it can be on any trunk highway. And the third eligibility criteria applies when we are funding the program with bonds. There are certain types of improvements that you can't make with bonds. And the most common ones that we would look at for that is it has to be a long-term solution because they're bonds. We're looking at something that has at least a 20-year life. We can't use it for purchasing right-of-way, and we can't use bonds for a project they're going to turn back. So most projects are fine, but there are some that would not be eligible because of that if bonds were the source of funding. So if the project now fits into at least one of those classes and has passed those eligibility tests, then what we did next was we prioritized the project based on some criteria, most again coming directly from the statute. For 2013, the program for 2013, project readiness was kind of the primary criterion because of the desire to take the available money and put it to work for the public as soon as possible, and also to avoid erosion of that money due to inflation. We determined that we wanted projects that we could get out there soon. And so it was our determination that projects that could begin as soon as possible after July 1st, 2014 would be the ones that we would give the highest priority to. If the program continues to be funded in the future and exists over a longer length of time, we would not have to be quite so concerned about project readiness. We could look at longer term projects, but for this program, we did give that the highest consideration. The second criterion was the return on investment. It's a measure that can provide us with a comparison across all different kinds of eligible projects. It helps, the return on investment helps capture the different characteristics of a project and allows us to compare them to each other. Characteristics like reduction in delay, improvement in safety, avoidance of detours, and it reflects that highways with higher traffic counts or higher truck traffic counts would have a higher rate of return. And the other criterion we used was that the statute gives greater priority to projects with local support. So in places that have regional plans, that may include compliance with a regional plan. It also would include lack of opposition. So if there's no opposition locally, that would be support for the project. There's several other factors that are mentioned in the statute that we didn't use specifically this time because we just didn't have that many projects that we needed to prioritize. But in the future, if we had more projects to prioritize, there are some other factors that we would also use. And these are some of them that we use in a couple of examples from that list. For example, for safety, we might give additional weight to a project that corrects a particularly high crash rate. Completes an intermodal connection might be a couple of the factors that would raise this priority of a project on the list. Corridors of Commerce is a competitive program, but it wasn't opened up to external applications, so it doesn't require an application like other programs do, like TED, for example, requires an application. For this program, MnDOT makes the project selections based upon the eligibility criteria and the prioritization factors. But the public is invited to nominate projects for consideration. So there was a solicitation of sorts where we asked the public to give us their recommendations on what they would like to see as a Corridors of Commerce project. And we would do that each year that there was a program to be funded. And we would first notify the public and ask them every year when we were about to select projects on which ones they preferred and if they had any others that they would recommend. The number of nominations wasn't a factor in the selecting of the projects, but of course if it got a lot, then we would look at that as being a sign of a strong public support. So for 2013, we did select 10 projects, and this is a map that you've probably seen before. It's also been made available to you on a separate handout, so you can see it a little better. 10 projects from around the state were selected to receive funding from the program. And those 10 projects were selected to make improvements in capacity and to remove bottlenecks at multiple locations across the system. The chart that's in the handout is from the program announcement that was made a few months ago. So looking ahead at what we have now and what we would do in the future, for the 2013 Quarters of Commerce program, that was looked at as a one-time investment. It was $300 million from the bond sales used for certain capacity projects on the trunk highway. MnDOT looked at this as a $300 million down payment on a desire to complete more projects that will enhance commerce in the state and address more than just the immediate needs. So we would be able to look at other projects with longer-term needs. The first year of the Corridors program, we used project readiness as the primary selection criteria and focused on really only two categories of the program, which were the expansion and freight preservation. Looking ahead, should the program continue into the future, when it's funded in the future, it would be our intent to do a broader range of projects than just the ones that we used this past time. There are actually five categories that we've created in the program. They are, one, to create capacity on rural inter-regional corridors, so outside the metro area. The second one is to create capacity inside the metro area. Third one is to remove freight bottlenecks anywhere in the state. The fourth one is to improve freight movement through preservation of existing infrastructure, so like the bridge replacements. And then the fifth category we call Main Street projects. It's for improving trunk highways that act as main streets in a community. This program would help us to rebuild the trunk highways that serve that purpose. And allow us to do a more extensive project than just maintaining the pavement. An ongoing Corridors of Commerce program would be able to look at longer-term needs. It wouldn't require that a project be shovel-ready to be considered if it was going to be in existence over a longer period of time. But it's also important to note that financing this program through further bond sales, as it stands right now, would be very limited. Because the debt policy will limit our abilities to use additional revenue from bonds. And one final point about the program is that system expansion does create additional needs for maintenance and operations. And there is an important provision in the Corridors of Commerce program that does allow us to allocate funds if they are so available and eligible to be used for maintenance and operations. So that's a good thing because these projects do create new maintenance and operations needs. Bonds in particular are the funding source that aren't available for that kind of a thing, but if other sources are made available, operations and maintenance would be one of the things that we would fund from the program. So looking ahead at what's next, the Corridors of Commerce projects will begin soon. Some of them will be beginning shortly after July 1st in 2014. Several others will be beginning next year in calendar year 2015. And as a part of the public involvement process that we went through for this, we did gather a nice list of projects, projects that people were interested in, projects that MnDOT was interested in, and we put that list together. It's kind of an active list that we add to as new ideas come forth. But that list will be available for us to use for a second round to help spark ideas for what the program could accomplish. And that, I'm finished and I'm available for questions or comments. Sure.
Thank you. We already have a couple questions. Thank you very much, Mr. Gieske. And I guess I would underline the point you made at the end, which is this is just the start. And unfortunately, without an additional funding source, we won't be able to take the next steps. But we have a couple, three people already on the list. Representative O'Neill, you can start us off here in 2014.
Thank you, Chair. And I, you know, on behalf of the I-94 Coalition, I see at least one person in the audience. Thank you, Steve Bott, for being here. I just want to thank you for selecting that as a project. And as I've become a little bit more familiar with the project moving forward and keeping track of the process, I'm a little confused because I sort of, and maybe my impression was incorrect, but my impression was once these projects had been announced and MnDOT had chosen them, that it was kind of, it was done. You know, and I guess in politics maybe nothing's ever done. But subsequently, I've discovered that actually, at least for the I-94 project, it's still going through a multiple Met Council meetings, at which, one, there was a protest vote against it because they didn't like the fact that it did not have managed lanes. So my question is if you could maybe give us a little bit more information about the process, because at least for myself, I had the impression that once this list was published that these had been chosen and approved and we were done, but that certainly was not the reality. So if maybe you could speak to that a little bit and about maybe if, you know, and I even see on this list that I-94 is listed the first steps towards a managed lane, which I understand that there's quite a bit of controversy around that as well. Maybe you could speak first to the process and secondly to specifically that project and why is managed lanes now a part of that project when that was...
Mr. Gieske.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Because the Corridors of Commerce program required us to use projects that were not in the STIP, we had to pull these projects forward or create them. So some of the pre-planning kind of things that you would normally do for a project that was a year or two out, you know, had to be compressed and done more quickly. So if it were a longer term program, you know, that you could plan for those kinds of things, but because we had to do it quickly, we tried to pick projects that we thought would have support. In some of those cases, though, the projects still had hoops to go through. They needed permits, they needed approvals. And we took that into consideration in the determination of when the project would be ready, hoping that we would be able to accomplish all of those hurdles and still get them let in a short period of time. That wouldn't be the way we'd want to do an ongoing program. We'd like to have a little more advanced ability to develop projects for the program. But that's how some of those things happen.
Follow-up, Representative O'Neill.
And specifically to the second question I had asked about managed lanes on I-94, how did that come into the picture as that wasn't the original project, I understand?
Mr. Gieske.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the project on I-94 was to add capacity to the segment without necessarily being specific about what that would be in the long term. We needed to do something that we could get approval for from the Metropolitan Council, from the FHWA, and so it was described in ways that we thought we could use it for whatever purpose in the future. So it's kind of a flexible addition. It's something that you can use for supporting a managed lane, or it's extra width for whatever kind of application we might envision for the future of the corridor, but it doesn't restrict the use of that additional lane by the project that we proposed.
Sorry, I'm still unclear.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you. I'm sorry, I'm still unclear. So are you going to move forward with or without managed lanes? Maybe you could just say yes or no.
The project is moving forward as an addition of an auxiliary lane on that segment. If in the future we are able to add more length, that additional length could be a managed lane or it could be something else. This project that we're building now won't preclude either option.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Gieske. Thank you, Representative O'Neill. We have a couple more people on the list. Representative Petersburg, followed by Representative Earhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's nice to be back here again, and nice to see everybody again. You probably know I'm going to be talking a little bit about Highway 14. Because I think that it is one of the corridors between Mankato and Rochester that is actually not connected directly to Minneapolis-St. Paul metropolitan area, and it's a major artery for southern Minnesota, and I really appreciate the Corridors of Commerce taking those recommendations to that area. But I did want to just clarify, because in some of them it appears from the wording that the section from Owatonna to Dodge Center now will be complete. And I just wanted to clarify that it's actually only 3 miles or less than 3 miles of the 16 miles that's left undone. And so where it says Rochester, Owatonna to Dodge Center, I just want to clarify that we still have a long ways to go. One of my questions is, as we start these progress projects and know there are still pieces left, is there any forward thought on how we continue on with those beyond what you've already stated at this point?
Mr. Gieske.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, when we talked about the program being a down payment, I think that's kind of what we were hoping, is that the program would continue in the future and projects like the rest of 14, which couldn't be made ready quickly enough for this first $100 million, would be, of course, good candidates for any future program, and that would be a way that we would hope to carry on with the rest of the projects to actually complete filling the gap.
Thank you for your future consideration.
Thank you. I think that Mr. Peterson would like to add something. Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Petersburg, I think it's important to note, just to kind of add to what Mr. Gieske said, is that we represented this as a down payment because this $300 million in bonds that we used to finance this program to date is really the last bit of borrowing that we can do under our existing revenue scenario. And as our plans, and you're, I know, familiar with this, that go out 20 years, we do not anticipate having the funds available to complete that project.
Thank you. So the last person for now on the list is Chairman Earhart.
I thank you, Mr. Chairman. Actually, the whole $300 million and more could have been spent on 14 alone, about $400 million, I think. But my question is this. Is this any better at picking projects and getting things underway and getting things done than you were doing before the SIP and the 15, 20, and 10-year, whatever your projections were before? How is this any better? Because you know all these things are got to be done, but, you know, how does this make a better way to do it?
Mr. Gieske.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the Corridors of Commerce program has very specific criteria for what kinds of projects we can do, where they are, and what they do, which is different than the kinds of projects we would pick through our normal program. Most of these projects were not in the plan or were many years out, but which is one of the conditions of the program. But the normal selection process would probably not have selected these, but additional revenue makes projects like this possible, so because it was new money and came with those conditions, we were able to select projects that wouldn't normally have been picked.
Chairman Earhart.
Who are you shorting them by doing this way, which you were doing before when you were doing it your other way? I mean, now somebody's getting shorted because they didn't get the $300 million spent for them. So.
Mr. Gieske.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I guess we look at the $300 million as having been revenue that we didn't have available before, so we didn't have to take anything away from anybody in order to do that. It could have been used for other things.
What I'm talking about is the list on your project. You said you replaced the way you were thinking about doing projects with the more directive orders of commerce when you got the money this time, instead of spending it the way you were normally. Which is a list and prioritized by your good folks over at MnDOT and so forth. So what?
Mr. Gieske.
So somebody lost. And what facet of our road system is losing?
I think Mr. Peterson's going to.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Earhart, as Mr. Gieske stated, we didn't take any funds away from any projects that were currently on our list. So in that sense, no projects were shorted. However, obviously, we dedicated $300 million of bond capacity that could have been spent on other projects. But we know that there is a significant demand, in particular from policymakers here at the legislature, to invest in these kinds of expansion projects because they represent the kind of the hopes and aspirations they have for the future of their communities or their corridors. And so You know, we saw the value in that, and as Mr. Giesecke stated, we look at this as a down payment to try to demonstrate the possibilities that are out there if MnDOT had funds available to invest in these kinds of projects on a consistent basis. And so we felt like it was a reasonable investment for those purposes. But you're right, that $300 million could have been spent on preservation projects, for which we have a backlog of need for those too. But that's kind of our thinking on the process.
Thank you. Our last question is from Representative Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And thank you, Chairman Earhart, for pointing out that we could have spent the $400 million on Highway 14. That would have pleased me, by the way, since that's really near and dear. And I understand that the 2.5 or 2.75 miles that's east of Owatonna that's going to be worked on in 14-15. That was right-of-ways were purchased, and that was shovel-ready, if you will. So moving forward, since I have a real interest in getting 14 done, from your standpoint, what are we going to need to do to get the rest of that shovel ready, and so that when and if this legislature works or acts on more bonding, more money, more revenue, how will that be prepared so that it can make an immediate list to get done? I'm very happy that the 2.5 miles, but if you look at the reasoning behind why we select these things to keep that 12 or 13 miles undone for another 20 years, really, I mean, we could say we threw the $16 million down the hole because we didn't complete it. I know that's not the probably best way to put it, nevertheless, but you know, what are we going to do to get the rest of that ready in the intervening time?
Either of you or both of you?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Benson, I think we need more revenue in order to invest in getting these projects ready. Right now, as I said, there really isn't, under our existing revenue forecast, we don't expect to have funds available to finish that four lane to Dodge Center. And so from our perspective, it would not make a wise investment of public funds to invest in the project development for a project that we at this time don't see an opportunity to construct. And so that's the short answer.
Thank you. Are there any other questions? Okay. Thank you very much. While we're doing the changing of the guard here, maybe for the next segment of our hearing, I wanted to just, if I'm not here at the end, which is possible because I have this other bill in committee, I just wanted to make a couple of other additional announcements. So tomorrow we have a hearing here at 10, our usual committee time, and it's a topic that is of interest to many people, so we'll probably have a larger crowd. So I'd encourage people to try to get here on time tomorrow at 10. And then tomorrow evening we have our dinner and program at the Humphrey, similar to what we had last year, or the U of M at McNamara Alumni Center. And so you have the information. Many of you have RSVP'd. If you still feel you can come and haven't RSVP'd, please talk to Matt. And then next week we have an evening hearing on the 4th, so make sure that you are aware of that. Regular committees, and then on the 7th we have our long-awaited field trip up to the test center on I-94. That's the one that Senator Dibble chided us because they had gone twice, apparently. I don't know. So now the House will have a chance to see the MnDOT test facility. So just we have a lot going on in a short amount of time here in our committee, so we appreciate everybody's flexibility and ability to make these meetings. So with that, we're going to transition now into our discussion about MnPass. And for those of you who weren't here when I initially introduced this topic, I'll just repeat again quickly that this particular part of the hearing came about as a result of some questions that Representative Holberg had asked both in committee and directly to MnDOT in a series of meetings that we had during the interim. And we wanted to make sure those questions were aired and answered. And I think it's an ongoing set of discussions. But this is kind of an update on both the MnPass system and an attempt to address some of the concerns that not only Representative Holberg has addressed, but I think those are somewhat reflective of you know, questions that people who particularly are using the MinPass on 35W are asking. Members, we're probably going to have a separate hearing maybe after deadline as an update on the broader UPA, you know, implementation of 35W. And, of course, MinPass is more than just 35W. So you have 494 and you have – I'm sorry, you have 394, and then you have other plans in the works. So this is a really important part of our transportation plan and our transportation infrastructure and congestion relief in the region, so this bears a lot of discussion. So I want to thank again Representative Holbrook for bringing it up, and the floor is yours, Mr. Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and members of the committee. I'm just going to briefly introduce the topic again and turn it over to the experts here, but I just wanted to stress a little bit that the ability to build a MinPass system in the metro area is really a key to preserving mobility in the metro area into the future. And I know we have heard a lot about the population growth that we expect in the metro area and the additional freight traffic that we expect to be on our roads in the future. And if one looks around the metro area, it's easy to see that we're physically constrained in many of our key metropolitan corridors. And that is that there's not a lot of room within the corridors to expand the width of the pavement to carry more traffic. In addition, investing in additional pavement just to carry peak period traffic really is not a very efficient investment in terms of the amount of people that it serves based upon the amount of money that it costs to invest. And if you think about how long the peak periods last in a given direction throughout the metro area, it's really a very small percentage of the number of hours in a work week or a conventional week. And so we think it's really a very efficient investment for the taxpayers in Minnesota, and it gives us an opportunity to really almost guarantee and preserve the mobility in these corridors by using a market-based approach, pricing to manage demand for transportation services in some of these high-volume corridors. And not only when the corridor is open, but on into the foreseeable future as we envision it. And really the key to the efficiency is that by managing demand, we can manage the speed of traffic in the corridor and also ensure that there's an opportunity for transit buses to operate at freeway speeds, and which makes their operations a lot more efficient too. And so I know Brad and Brian will get into some of the details and numbers to kind of back that up, but it's really in our two corridors where we have it in place, it's really been very effective, and we have a lot of satisfied customers, although as you point out, Mr. Chairman, we also do have some questions out there among the traveling public, because it's the way it operates and how it works is not immediately obvious to people who are out there. And so we appreciate the opportunity to come here and talk about it in some detail.
Yeah, and yeah, I do very much appreciate your preparation and as well as the time you spent in the interim with us. So proceed. And please welcome back to the committee, and please state your name for the record.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair and members, for the opportunity to speak with you about the MinPass Express Lane system. My name is Brad Larson with MnDOT. I'm the MinPass Policy and Planning Program Director.
And my name is Brian Carey. I'm the Freeway Operations Engineer, or responsible for the MinPass operations.
The main things we're going to cover here today are why MinPass has been adopted by MnDOT as a key strategy for addressing congestion and improving the mobility of our highway and transit systems in the metro area, as well as how it's currently performing out there on the existing system, where we're planning to expand it within the region, and then finish up talking about what we're doing to try to improve the system currently. Before I begin, I just want to provide a little more context. Scott did a nice job, but a little more context for why MinPass is a key regional strategy for improving the highway and transit systems. Many of you have heard Commissioner Zelli talk about the gap between transportation funding and transportation needs. the vast majority of our state highway funding is needed just to maintain the state highway system in its current condition over the next 20 years. So there's going to be very little money that's available to address congestion issues and improve mobility in the Twin Cities area. Notwithstanding the corridors of commerce projects that we were talking about, our 20-year highway investment plan, state highway investment plan, MNCHIP, only projects 7% of our state road construction budget over the next 20 years being available to address Twin Cities congestion and mobility issues. That's the equivalent of about $520 million is all over the next 20 years going to address Twin Cities congestion and mobility needs. Not a lot of money. And all of that $520 million is projected in the first 10 years of the plan. Second 10 years of the 20-year plan, there's no money to address the congestion and mobility issues in the Twin Cities area. So given that limited amount of funding, we've adopted some key strategies for really how to get the most bang out of that limited amount of funding. These strategies that I list on this slide, active traffic management strategies, our internet and 511 information systems, our first responder vehicles, our ramp meters, all these things we've been doing for a number of years and we're going to continue doing them, they're very low cost strategies that have a high return on investment. You can see the return on investment range. We're also another group of strategies are the spot mobility improvements, adding auxiliary lanes in certain spots and turn lanes and interchange improvements. Have a high return on investment. Then I'm going to talk to you more today about the MNPASS express lane strategy, and then we also have strategic capacity improvements like the completion of 610 on here.
Mr. Chairman, can I get an explanation of the return on investment things that you're using here?
Thank you very much, Chairman Earhart. Proceed, Mr. Larson, on that, or anyone who wants to take the...
These return on investments, like these ranges, for example, with active traffic management, the high range of 12 there. So for every dollar we invest in these strategies, the public gets $12 in return. These ranges came out of a recent study that we just did, looking at a whole host of our highway strategies and analyzing all of them, came up with calculated these return on investment ranges.
Well, Mr. Chairman, is this a national something or other that you're using compared to Chicago or Detroit or something, or is it something that the department made up and that's their scale to work on?
The report, as I understand it, uses kind of standard best practices for how you calculate return on investment. It used the data that we have here in Minnesota and some of the analysis that has already been done on certain types of these improvements.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
Representative Earhart, the benefits that are used to calculate the ratio include reduced travel time. So by using these strategies, we increase traffic speed and reduce congestion, the benefit of avoided crashes and the costs that would otherwise have to the public, and then reduced operating costs. For example, if you're sitting in stop-and-go traffic, you're using a lot more gas than you would be if you were traveling at 55 miles an hour. And so we estimate the impacts of these strategies on those three factors, put a dollar value on those, compile them, and divide them by the cost. And that's a very standard approach to this type of calculation.
Okay, Representative Mahoney has a question. Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm just wondering, is that the same ROI type standards that you use for the Stillwater Bridge? I'm waiting for the answer on this one.
Who would like to answer that question?
Madam Chair, Representative Mahoney, those would be the same factors that we would use in calculating return on investment for this loan.
So, Madam Chair.
Yeah, Representative Mahoney.
So, if someone suggested a toll for the St. Croix Bridge, what would be the ROI dollar figure of that I should be able to charge for, you know, if we're saving all those consumers that much money? What was maybe $5, $10?
Mr. Peterson.
Madam Chair, Representative Mahoney. I don't know the answer to that question right off the top
but you'd
of
get
head,
back
but
to
we
me?
Did we did a study on that very topic a few years ago, and that's available to any member who's interested. And I think what it recommended was that the revenue maximizing toll would be in the neighborhood of $3 each way.
So, Madam Chair.
Okay, Representative Mahoney.
And then I'll be done. ROI studies are, you know, subjective at best, because frankly, in a committee that I sit on, if I went with all the ROIs that, you know, they tell me I'm going to save money on, I really wouldn't have to ask the general fund for any money, which is always amusing to me. So ROI is kind of it's not as, I want to be careful here. It doesn't provide as much comfort to us as it might to other people. So just so you know, ROIs are kind of overused. So explain to us why this is a better way to go in terms of, you know, is it going to serve people better? You know, does it help commerce? Are the people going to be able to get home sooner or pick up their children and get dinner on the table sooner and have some quiet time with their kids? Or in my case, crazy time with my kids? You know, those are the kind of things that I would hope would sell us on these particular items. I mean, you're putting one through my district or close by my district, not quite in my district. I get the idea of what they are and how soon they can calm traffic and get through faster, but please don't use ROI. I mean, I at least for me.
Well, Mr. Larson, before we have you proceed with your presentation, we have one more question, and that's Representative Hausman.
Madam Chair, just a comment. Quite a number of years ago, I introduced a bill that said if the Stillwater Bridge is ever built, it must be a toll bridge. I heard from absolutely not one single person in Minnesota, but I was editorialized against in Wisconsin about this incredibly mean thing I was proposing. So I think we've always known who we built that bridge for, and you may have seen the article in the paper that talked about this boom of development that they're anticipating very soon now, which will put extra burden on Highway 36.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Mr. Larson, would you like to proceed with your presentation?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I should also say about these strategies, they are essentially in the order of how we like to approach congestion mobility issues on corridors. We first like to try to exhaust these active traffic management strategies to address issues because they do have the lowest cost and provide more benefits compared to the cost generally. Next, if we've exhausted those strategies, we look to the spot mobility improvements to see if some of those improvements can help address the issue. Next, we move on to the MinPass express lane option and study the feasibility of that option if it's really if the issue demands a longer-term capacity, longer capacity type improvement. And then finally, if none of those options really work, we'd look to the final option. Within all these strategies, we are really following some key principles to try to get that better return on investment of those limited dollars we're trying to maximize the use of the existing infrastructure out there as well as the existing right-of-way, trying to squeeze every ounce of performance we can get out of that existing system and those existing facilities. We're also trying to time these mobility improvements so that they're happening when bridge and pavement preservation projects are occurring in these corridors, so that they're more efficient and more cost-effective approach. We're also really looking to the solution that's going to have the shortest implementation time frame to minimize disruption to the traveling public. And finally, we're also really looking to improve transit advantage features when we're out there looking at these solutions. But turn now to focus on the MinPass strategy itself, explain a little bit about what it is and how it's working. MinPass is the name for Minnesota's priced managed lanes system. It uses market-based pricing principles to improve the efficiency of the region's highway and transit systems when it's needed the most during peak weekday recurring congestion. The purpose of this pricing is to maintain a congestion-free condition in the MinPass lane. It's not to generate some amount of revenue. We've had these MinPass lanes in operation on 394 since 2005 and on 35W since 2009. MinPass lanes typically operate only during the weekday AM and PM peak rush hour periods, and at all other times they revert to general purpose lanes and are open and free to all to use. There are a couple exceptions on our MinPass system: the 394 reversible section and the 35W price dynamic shoulder lane section, which do have longer hours of operation, have some other unique operating characteristics. MinPass lanes during peak periods when they're in an operation, transit buses, carpools, so vehicles with two or more passengers in them, and motorcycles can use the lanes for free. Solo drivers have the option to use the lanes for a fee. The objectives that we have for the MinPass system are to improve the movement of people through highway corridors during peak periods. We also say increase person throughput. Also to offer a faster, more reliable, congestion-free choice for commuters, improve the bus transit service, increase ridership, improve park and ride performance, and increase carpooling and vanpooling. MinPass is really delivering on these objectives. This slide shows that the vast majority of people using MinPass are either riding on transit or in carpools. Single occupant MinPass customers make up about a third of the vehicles in the MinPass lanes, but they only represent about 12% of the people using the lanes. These lanes move significantly more people than general purpose lanes during peak hour congestion. You can see by these examples on more than twice as many people on northbound 35W at Lake Street during the morning rush hour. Nearly twice as many people on eastbound 394 Penn Avenue in the morning rush hour. They're not only moving more people during these rush hour periods, they're moving them a lot faster. The average speeds on the MinPass lanes are between 55 to 60 miles per hour, whereas in the general purpose lanes, they're moving at 15 to 20 miles per hour. Federal law requires us to, requires price managed lanes to operate at speeds above 45 miles per hour at least 90% of the time. Currently, our MinPass system is meeting that requirement 95% of the time. A fast, predictable, reliable transportation system is very important to a region's economic competitiveness and its quality of life. MinPass lanes provide more predictability and reliability than general purpose lanes. This example here, if you're traveling on northbound 35W between Lakeville and Minneapolis during the morning peak period, you have to plan for, it's tough to know exactly how bad congestion is going to be, but you have to plan for about a 28-minute trip using the general purpose lanes. Well, with MinPass, you can plan for half that time, and a 14-minute trip. That's very important if you need to get somewhere on time, or if you're a business that needs to get somebody to a job site on time or deliver a product on time. MinPass has resulted in some significant improvements to transit. This is examples from 35W since MinPass went in the corridor. Operating speeds for express bus service have increased, resulting in better on-time performance. Ridership is up 34%. Fare box recovery, 70% of operating costs, one of the highest fare box recovery rates in the metro area. And park and rides have improved on the corridor. Park and ride use is up 35% since MinPass went in. So not only is carpooling and transit use growing on the MinPass lanes, also the single occupant MinPass customer use is also seeing strong, steady annual growth, reaching nearly 2.25 million trips in 2013.
Oh, excuse me, Representative Hausman.
To that slide, what happened in 2011? Is there an explanation for that?
Mr. Larson?
Yes, we saw a little dip on 394. Madam Chair and Representative Hausman. We saw a slight dip in 2011 on 394. And I believe that was due to, correct me if I'm wrong, Brian, but it was a period where we were in, we were still in the economic slowdown. We were seeing some reductions in VMT, vehicle miles traveled, region-wide. Could have been during a period when there were gas prices were higher than they had been in some time. Do you have anything to add, Brian?
Okay, proceed, Mr. Larson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is just hard to see, but shows you where MinPass account holders come from, primarily around the metro area here, with the highest percentages coming from Lakeville, then the Wayzata, Deep Haven, Orono area, and then Burnsville. Customer satisfaction ratings very high, over 80% among the single occupant MinPass customers. They say that they value the time savings, congestion avoidance, the choice and reliability most. Customers tend to stay customers. Also, we have strong support from transit operators, users, as well as the carpooler and vanpoolers. So now moving away from how the current system is performing, I want to talk a little bit about where we're looking to expand the system in the future. This 2030 transportation policy plan based map depicts the MinPass price managed lane vision within the metro area. The segments in green you see on here are where it currently exists on 394 and 35W. The segment in red, north of St. Paul, is where they're currently under construction. Between 694 and downtown St. Paul, that project is adding an additional MinPass lane in that corridor in each direction, due to open November 2015. Most of the other corridors you see here in yellow are in various stages of MinPass planning and development. We recently just completed a study on the 35W corridor north of Minneapolis, which recommended adding a MinPass lane in each direction along that corridor. The first phase of from that from the recommendations of that study, between Highway 36 and Highway 10 is about to enter the environmental and pre-design phase. We've got studies that are nearing completion on Highway 77 in the South Metro, as well as 94 between Minneapolis and St. Paul. We have a study about midway through on 35E, further north of where the lanes are currently being built, so looking at taking them further north from where they're going to end under the current construction up through County Road 96. And then we're considering studies on the 94, 494, Highway 36, and US 169 corridors presently. A lot of work going on. We're also working with the city of Lakeville, evaluating the potential for a MinPass extension on 35, I-35 down through Lakeville. So lots of activity going on. We're hopeful that we'll be able to have 2 to 3 more of these MinPass corridors built within the next 10 years with potential funding increases. Hopefully maybe even more of the system can be built out. Just a little more information on how MinPass works. MinPass utilizes all electronic dynamic pricing. There's no toll booths. These are very different from the traditional old toll roads that most people think of when you talk about toll facilities. The prices can change every 3 minutes on the corridor. The price ranges from 25 cents up to $8. You can see the average tolls for the last quarter in each of the corridors. Pavement loop detectors that are in the MinPass lanes monitor the speeds and volumes. That data then is used to automatically adjust the rates to either decrease demand for the lane or increase demand for the lane. That's how it keeps it flowing at a congestion-free speed. And once again, that's the purpose of the pricing, is to maintain that congestion-free condition. It's not to generate revenue.
Mr. Larson, we have a question. Did you want to ask it now, Representative Hobart?
Madam Chair, I just wait. When they're done, I have a number of questions.
So you're planning ahead here. Okay. Yeah. Go ahead, proceed.
I just want to be on the list.
Okay, thank you. Proceed, Mr. Larson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. MinPass is easy to use. If you're a transit user or carpooler, don't have to do anything. Just when you're out in the lane during congestion, you can use the lane for free. If you're a solo driver, you need to go set up a MinPass account online by phone or in person. You put down a $40 credit card deposit. You receive and mount this electronic transponder device on your windshield. There's a $1.50 a month lease fee associated with that transponder. Then when you're driving the corridor, you see the price in the lane. You decide whether or not you want to use it. And if you get in the lane, that price fee is automatically deducted from your account. I wanted to provide a little bit of information on MinPass finances. Minnesota Statute 160.93 requires that you establish a separate account for each corridor and prescribes how the revenue it must be used in each of these corridors. With 394, the revenue must first be used to repay the implementation costs of MinPass on that corridor. And you can see those repayments in yellow on this chart. The last repayment is actually occurred last year in fiscal 13. So we've paid off all of the implementation costs for 394. Next, after implementation costs, you pay for operating costs. You can see that in red on here. And then any revenue remaining after those paying for those costs is split 50-50 between MnDOT and the Met Council for highway and transit improvements within the 394 corridor. In these years where expenses exceed toll revenue, we use trunk highway funds to cover those expenses. In the future, we will have additional expenses that will show up on this chart for the replacement of the toll infrastructure that exists out there. Some of it is getting close to reaching the end of its useful life. And in 2015, actually, we're going to start seeing those costs hitting this. And then since we're done with repaying the implementation costs on the corridor, our first revenue distribution with payment to the Met Council will occur this year, 2014. 35W, the revenue distribution rules are quite a bit more complicated, and I apologize. You can't see them on here. They get complicated, and I'm not going to go through them in detail, other than to just mention that one aspect of 35W that's different from 394 is that you do not first have to use revenue to pay off the implementation costs on 35W. There's no requirement to pay off any implementation costs. So once again, the total revenues in green, operating costs in red, and then you see because it's a different calculation for how you calculate how much the Met Council payments are, you can see the Met Council payments in orange on this chart. Once again, in the years where expenses exceed revenue, we use trunk highway funds to cover those expenses. And we will eventually be showing toll infrastructure replacement costs here as well. There's one more account within the MNPAS system. It's the administrative account. And this account takes in the revenue from the transponder lease fees, that $1.50 a month lease fee that's associated with the transponders, plus miscellaneous administrative fees, late payment fees, those types of things. And we didn't start paying operating expenses against this account until 2011. Previous to that, these operating expenses that you see in this account were actually a charge to either the 394 or 35W account. But it made sense for what these operating expenses are to charge them to this account rather than the other accounts. The big spike you see in 2013 there, the main expense we have in this account is the replacement of transponders. And we had a big transponder order in 2013 that accounts for that spike. Madam Chair, that's about all I had on MNPAS, other than Chairman Hornstein had asked for just a quick update on the Urban Partnership Agreement, and then I was just going to close talking about some of the areas of focus that we have for improving the MNPAS system, which gets to probably some of Representative Holberg's questions. If I may, yes. I'll just quickly go through these last two slides.
Please do, Mr. Larson.
Thank you. Many of you may recall this 35W Urban Partnership Agreement. The region was successful in receiving a large federal competitive grant to implement this 21st century highway improvement pilot that involved 27 different projects involving transit, technology, tolling. MNPAS was part of this project, telecommuting improvements along the 35W corridor. You can see the total cost of $207 million. Recently, FHWA completed an evaluation of this pilot project and published a report. It's a before-after type report. And I've listed some of the key findings from that report. Some of the key transit findings I already mentioned earlier on in the study. But as Representative Hornstein said, that at some future date, the committee may want to hear more details on the results of this urban partnership agreement project and the evaluation from it. Just going to close. Even though MNPAS has been working very well out on the system now for nearly a decade, there are still many areas of improvement that we are focused on. I mentioned trying to expand the system, so trying to expand the benefits FinPass can provide and create more of that network throughout the Twin Cities region. We're also focusing on improving operations, trying to improve the value to the different user groups out on the corridor. The U of M is completing a study looking at the pricing algorithm, ways that we can improve that algorithm to try to encourage greater use of the MinPass lanes, particularly during the caller hours when they're not used as much, and this has been something we've been speaking with Representative Holberg about. Also looking at ways to improve access on the corridors and hours of operation so that we are trying to encourage as great a use of the MinPass lanes as possible. There's going to be improvements with signing coming to the 35E corridor when that's built that we eventually want to move to the other corridors as well. They're going to be all digital type signs where we can provide better messaging to people traveling the corridor so that they know when the lanes are open and free to use for all and when they're actually in MinPass operation and have restrictions. We're working with the State Patrol who handles our enforcement out in these lanes to try to make the enforcement more efficient and improve the cost effectiveness of it. And then our five-year operations contract, we're beginning the work on renewing that. And it's going to be a big deal because within that contract renewal, we're going to be dealing with the new federal MAP 21 requirement that all electronic toll systems around the country become interoperable by 2016. And so that MinPass would be able to be used on like Chicago's iPass system and vice versa. So that type of thing. And so incorporating that type of change into this next operations contract is going to be a lot of work, but I think we're going to end up out of it with a lot of benefit. And then continually trying to improve our MinPass communication. So with that, I will stop and take questions.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Larson. Representative Holberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And first, I want to thank the gentlemen at the table. They've tolerated my rants and raves about this corridor for a number of years, and I appreciate their willingness to listen. They've already made some minor changes, and I'm appreciative of that. I would caution this body. They have been before the legislature a number of times asking for blank authority to implement MinPass lanes in the system as they see fit. And until they're able to address some of the concerns that I'm going to lay out, I would caution this body of not giving them that authority. The successes in the corridor, the highest fare box recovery in the commuter bus line coming out of Lakeville, and we don't care if they live within the transit taxing district or not. The fact that they get on a bus in our community is great. The problems are that when you have this corridor and it is tolled, then for those that do not have transponders, they're left in the remaining lanes. And what it actually, there's an adverse impact of constraining mobility in the non-tolled corridors. And it was never meant that this should be a money-making operation, but a balance of charging the right price to make sure that the tolled lanes, that the buses run, and that we quote-unquote sell the unused capacity to single occupancy drivers and control that by the higher the price, the less people that, of course, will use it. And it just has some really adverse and frustrating odd results. We have double white lines that go forever, so if you get in that lane, you can't get off on a particular area of the highway. Representative Rosenthal and I have talked about this in Bloomington. On days where, say, it's a federal holiday, you don't need this even told, really, because of the lack of traffic. And so I've challenged them to try and make this more dynamic, if you will, and that you could turn it off as need be, but that if Christmas Day falls on a Wednesday and everybody's going to church or visit their relatives and nobody can get into the left lane, the buses aren't even running, it really doesn't even make sense. And they were concerned about, whether continuity of use. And I said, well, you know, people can figure out which lanes are open at the grocery store. There's got to be a way to sign these lanes in a more dynamic way so that people know if they're being told or if they're open to the general public. And I believe all of these changes, that there's a way to fix this and do this. But I think we were going to really have to push MnDOT, to work on it. The fact that they have a new contract for all this equipment coming up in 15, now is the perfect opportunity to try and set these new standards and allow for this to work. And two other major concerns. These corridor revenues are actually paying, I believe, hundreds of thousands of dollars a year to the State Patrol out of these funds to pay for the monitoring and enforcement. That just seems wrong to me that we're paying them extra money to do what they should be doing anyway. But maybe if that isn't the case, then maybe some of the revenue generated as a result of that investment should come back to these corridors. And then my forever irritant is how these things are priced. And I on particular days have made note, and they said they're trying to get better. And unfortunately for them, last Thursday, I traveled through this corridor, and certainly it was a day that there was a snowstorm, and got on the freeway at 494 heading south, and literally there were four different, and I have this little scrap of paper receipt from my car, as I hit the fourth dollar value in that short corridor of what they were charging within minutes, and there was no congestion in the far left lane, a little congestion in the other lanes, and the price went from 75 cents to a buck to 50 to 125 in Burnsville. I mean, so there was no rhyme or reason. And I was like, oh, the first two numbers, I was like, oh, yeah, whatever. And then by the time I got to the four number, I was like, oh, H-E, double hot sticks, no, this is crazy. And so I grabbed the piece of paper to write these numbers down because you talk about the algorithm, and I get that, but there is no reason that this would even make sense, that you'd have costs going up and down within that short a period of time. So I'm just using this opportunity to kind of state the issue, and we've been working a number of years, and it is very popular. Many of my colleagues hate toll lanes. I would defend the value of MnPass. I think it's valuable. I think it works. But I think it can do a lot better. And then just as a final note on your numbers, where you take, if you're just using zip codes with Lakeville, the city of Lakeville actually has three different zip codes that are used within the city. And the 55044 zip code has a large portion of southern Scott County and southern Dakota County that are actually outside the city. So I'm not sure your numbers are accurate as far as the city of the Lakeville area would maybe be more appropriate. But if anybody wants any more information or to talk about it, but I'm just kind of laying it all out there, and hopefully they keep meeting the challenges.
There wasn't really a question.
I'm certain that they might maybe want to comment, but I do have, they have been very good about trying to work these things. But as a public policy body, please, please, please do not give them blanket authority to put these things all over the Twin Cities without addressing some of these issues.
Well, that was kind of a partial question. Did you want to comment before you?
Madam Chair, Representative Holberg, these issues that Representative Holberg is raising are
Mr. Peterson.
Not new. I mean, we've been talking about them, as she indicated, and some of them are valid points, and we're trying to improve the algorithm and issue is one that we're actively working with the University of Minnesota to try and take some of the volatility out of that, because we know it's perplexing to users and it's not behaving necessarily in a way that we anticipated, I would say, probably when we put it in. And the double white line issue is also not new. And so We'll continue to explore those opportunities. I don't know for sure, but I think the way we are operating this type of system in Minnesota is unique to Minnesota, and so we're, you know, literally learning from our experience and trying to make improvements as we go along, but we're actively engaged in evaluating and improving the system.
Okay, thank you. We have three more people on the, or four? Yeah, four more. Hopefully we can get through because we're concluding at 11:30. Representative Howell. Representative Howell.
Well, thank you. I thought there was other people in line before me, but I guess coming from greater Minnesota and knowing that I've got a bunch of folks out there that don't use this very often, has the use and the restrictions of that lane, how do you message that to those folks that commute from greater Minnesota or probably outstate that come through and don't even understand that they can't use that lane, or if they want to use the lane, they got to get a transponder? What's the time lag? How do you message that, and how have you been messaging that to those commuters from outstate Minnesota?
Sure. Madam Chair and the committee, to answer the question, we have a number of signs on the corridor.
Could you please state your name?
Oh, sorry. Brian Carey, Freeway Operations, and I'm in charge of the in-pass operations. As far as the signs go, there are a number of regulatory signs roughly about every mile as you're driving on the corridor over that lane, and that lane gives information as to who can use the lane. So it'll say carpools, buses, motorcycles, and MinPass, and then it'll say when the lane is restricted. It'll say Monday through Friday from 6 to 10 or 3 to 7, depending on the corridor.
Okay, Representative Howell.
Thank you, Madam Chair, but I guess that's great when you're there. Mm-hmm. What are you doing ahead of time to tell these folks that this lane even exists, or that there's a transponder even required, or what has been done to try to message that to the folks that are new to the system in the metro area?
Mr. Carey?
Mainly in the metro, we've done some marketing, but yeah, it hasn't really reached out to the outstate. And then we do have, you know, certainly our webpage, but probably. You know, haven't done a whole lot of marketing out in the outstate at all, but we've done it certainly in the metro area to inform people as to what these lanes are.
And then one more, and I'll be done. But thank you, Madam Chair. The acts, and I that's what I was leaning over to talk to Representative Holberg was about, was who's got access to the transponder data, how's it used, and that type of thing. I think that is something you got to message also to those users, because they need to know that's available, and who's got access to it.
Right.
Mr. Perry?
Yeah, we don't have, like, any way of actually, you know, like, tracking an individual. It's tracking a transponder and billing that account. And then the individual can see, you know, when their account was charged, but, you know, there's no way to, like, use it for, you know, any kind of privacy concerns of tracking somebody.
Okay, so we're going to move on, if that's okay with you. We have four people left on the list. I'd like to wrap up in 3 minutes, so hopefully you can be concise. Representative Hausman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Really, just a comment. This has been always one of those that I had a certain level of frustration about, because suddenly there was some federal money available with very tight parameters, and it had to fit just those parameters, and we went after it, and we were one of only five states, which probably tells you something about the advisability of this. And I think it was touted at the time as this great, inexpensive project that was available to us. But what I'd suggest is, on this slide that says total cost, that it really should say cost to date, because we are not finished with it yet. We have several bills right now, you'll probably speak to one, where really it isn't finished. The design isn't finished. It isn't working. And so I would say this is not the total cost. We should call it cost to date, and that it's a project in process.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I wanted to speak specifically to Representative Holberg's point about giving blanket authority. And before I do that, though, I just want to thank you for your service, because I know that this weekend you announced your retirement, and you will be sorely missed, particularly on this committee. And so I just wanted to acknowledge that and thank you for your service here. To your point specifically about blanket authority, and I appreciate what you said, Representative Hausman, I see that there are many, many issues, and I would also urge the committee as well, along your points as well, Representative Hausman, that we don't just give blanket authority And to that point specifically, you know, I'm kind of the, I love to look at the budgets and the numbers, and just looking at the two different corridors and how the revenue is used, they're vastly different. One is there's a requirement to pay back the implementation and then to go to the operations, and yet the other corridor doesn't have to pay back implementation, and it is some of the operations costs, but by and large, without even having the implementation paid, now we're paying that council. So those are two vastly different funding pictures. You know, and I personally have a problem with implementing something and not paying for it. So if there's revenue generated, I would think, now I understand this is probably statutory, but if we are thinking about doing something like that, we certainly should have a funding mechanism to pay back the implementation. And I, at least the 394 has that in place, that at least we're paying back the implementation. But I think that's something that we really, really need to strongly consider, you know, if we're going to be moving forward. And I think that's something that that we should be doing here, maybe, as opposed to just kind of giving blanket authority. Also, I also wanted to comment on Representative Holberg's point about the congestion in the remaining open lanes. And I see that I-94 is listed as a potential moving forward. And I can tell you that all three lanes are maxed out already. And when it goes down to two lanes, it doesn't move, which is why we're very appreciative of the expansion. But we already have buses moving on our shoulders. So I have a fear as to what Representative Holberg already mentioned, the fact that we're going to be compressing into the remaining open lanes so much traffic that, as you already pointed out, the average speed is 15 miles an hour. And I don't know that that's the best way to get people moving on our roads, but I just have a caution there. And finally, my final point is this is the unsession, and so I would put out a plea that, you know, I had mentioned earlier about the I-94 and having to go through, I looked at this, six separate Met Council meetings, six meetings, after it's already been on this list of approved, semi-approved, however you want to phrase it, project. And I would just implore us to look at that and possibly streamline six entire different meetings to approve the same bit of project. So I would just move that forward. And I don't have a question. I just have those comments. Thank you.
Representative Mason and then Representative Metza.
Madam Chair and panel, first of all, is there any proof that you have that people are either encouraged or discouraged from using the routes that have MinPass? Mm-hmm. Or are we just talking about a captive audience no matter what?
Who would like to answer that? Someone have an answer, or do you want to get back to Representative Mason? Mr.
It's like
Larson.
A television show.
Madam Chair and Representative, I'm not sure if we have the type of data to answer your question available. It's an interesting question. Certainly, any corridor that has a reliable, congestion-free option on it should be more attractive to commuters than a corridor that is congested and that's going to take you twice as long to get through and is unreliable. So, but I don't think we have any data that shows that because these corridors have MinPass on them that they have attracted more users to these corridors. That would be tough to probably analyze because there's so many factors in play.
Representative Mason?
I do want to make one question. Looking at the results of that report, it does say crash rates were decreased by 20% to 25%. Now, that's huge. But going back to the average speed, I mean, there's a considerable difference between using the MinPass lane and using the other one. So basically what we're doing is slowing the traffic in those three, so the people that really want to go fast are in that one. Is
Mr. Larson? And
that's my thought, is the way we're just squeezing the stuff.
Yeah, Madam Chair and Representative, our approach to these corridors is essentially adding lanes in them, so the traffic is already flowing at a congested speed. So adding this option improves, not only provides that congestion-free free flow MinPass lane option, but it does, at least at the outset, it will improve the flow of the general purpose lanes as well. And there's no doubt that as traffic volumes grow in these corridors, that the free general purpose lane will become more congested, and there will be a bigger differential in speeds between the general purpose lanes and the MinPass lanes. And it is a safety concern, but we really haven't seen any data that has shown that crash rates increase because of that speed differential so far. Is that correct, right?
Yeah, that's correct.
Carey?
We've had the university study that's looking at the different access control at the double white lines comparing 394 and 35W. And that was some of the concern and why we had the double white lines on the 394 corridor and much less double white on 35W. And so we wanted to see, you know, what kind of influence that had on safety as well as the mobility in that MinPass lane. And the university has really found that the open access does work, that there wasn't any kind of increase or in crashes or any kind of concern with safety there. So that's why we're going to kind of take a look at both corridors in the design and looking at that access control with that double white and maybe looking at opportunities to open that up.
Thank you.
Okay. Representative Metza.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I just, due to the rising concerns I have about the environmental and economic impacts of projects like this, I was wondering if you could hold three hearings maybe in our greater Minnesota areas to allow our constituents to thoroughly vet those impacts.
Yeah, Chair, Representative.
Mr. Larson.
We'd be happy to have some discussions with you and explore the ideas that you might have. So,
okay, and we'll conclude the meeting with a question from Representative Earhart.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If I get on the lane at 50 cents and you switch it to $8, is there any way that I know that so I can get off the lane?
Mr. Carey.
Yes, Madam Chair and Representative Earhart, you're actually locked into the price that you see as you enter the lane. So if the price does change, you would be locked into what that first price was.
Okay. Thank you for everyone for your patience in us finishing up. It was a lively conversation, and appreciate our testifiers today. Thank you, and our meeting is adjourned.